Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, beginning the readings for Far West News. I am reading on Thursday, January 28, 2021. One programming note, because of technical difficulties, the Fort Stockton Pioneer will not be presented this week. I'll be reading from the Big Bend Sentinel, published Wednesday, January 27th. Jail inspection shows great cleanliness, some room to improve. Marfa. The Presidio County Jail has at times faced challenges meeting certain standards during inspections by the Texas Commission on Jail Standards, but at the annual inspection this year, the county passed with few issues and some high praises. A jail inspection involves not just the physical building, according to Brandon Wood, executive director of the Texas Commission on Jail Standards. Founded in 1975 by the Texas legislature, the government agency looks at everything from the locks, intercoms, and toilets to the actual inmate files to make sure they were booked and classified properly, Wood said. They also ensure cleanliness, and on that note, the jail inspector made a special note that the Presidio County facility was found to be very clean and well-maintained during the inspection, which happens at an unannounced time every year. The inspector also speaks with inmates, reviews complaints, and walks through the entire site. Across the entire inspection, there was only one area that the inspector said needed correction. The facility received a notice of non-compliance that had to do with inmate discipline procedure. Anytime an inmate violates a jailhouse rule, the jail makes records and can hold a hearing to determine whether the inmate violated a rule. Once the hearing ends, they can assess penalties, such as time in segregation or suspension of privileges. Part of that process is the inmate has to be given 24 hours notice prior to the hearing taking place. It's considered due process, and what the inspector found was that the jail was not doing that in this case, said Wood. That was the only thing that was determined to be significant enough to issue a notice of noncompliance. The jail has a chance to resolve their noncompliance by submitting a corrective plan of action that will be reviewed, Wood explained. Once they demonstrate they have a pattern of compliance, we will reinspect and then certify them. Jail Administrator Garcia Parras could not comment on the inspection, and the request was forwarded to Sheriff Danny Dominguez, who did not respond. Issues that can be resolved quickly on site don't count against the jail in the inspection. Wood said there were one or two employees that didn't get the life-saving training immediately upon employment, but they did manage to address that. We've had some tough times previously, but they've done an excellent job, and I'm very proud of this last inspection, Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara said. In recent years, the jail has had to close as the county repaired water leaks into electrical wiring and replaced the entire HVAC system in order to be in compliance with jail standards. Many sections of the roof had to be replaced to pass inspection to open up again, and the whole jail inside was detailed, from shower heads to drains to all of the painting. It looked really good, and they've kept it up and maintained it, said Guevara. After lawsuit, tension continues between Village Farms and Workers Legal Aid Group, by Stephen Paulson. Village Farms is reiterating its commitment to worker safety at its tri-county facilities after a worker at a Monahans greenhouse last year sued the company over its coronavirus response. That lawsuit from worker Maria de los Angeles Calzada Navarrete alleges that the company wasn't doing enough to provide safe housing to workers or quickly notify them of possible COVID exposures. The lawsuit was brought by Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, a nonprofit legal assistance group. Without admitting wrongdoing, Village Farms settled the case before trial and agreed to several policies, including notifying workers of possible exposures within 24 hours, allowing exposed workers time off for free COVID tests, offering housing for workers in quarantine, and promptly reporting cases to state health workers. Darren Gemmel, the Vice President of Human Resources, Administration and Compliance for the company's Texas operations, said in an interview on Monday that the company was implementing or had already implemented those same policies at its facilities near Marfa and Fort Davis. But now tensions are once again building between Village Farms and TRLA after the nonprofit last week published a news release on the settlement. The news release said Village Farms deserves credit for coming to the negotiating table quickly, but it also made statements that Village Farms took issue with, including that Village Farms was now bound by a federal consent decree. TRLA is standing behind the news release. "We believe it accurately reflects the resolutions of the case and the facts of the consent decree," said Bob Elder, a spokesperson for the group. Village Farms took issue with several aspects of the news release, including the line about the consent decree. "It suggested that the company was being forced to protect workers," Gemmel said. "I absolutely believe this is defamation," he said of the news release in an interview on Monday. "It was not written with a clear vision of what happened and what we discussed." A lawyer for Village Farms had contacted TRLA, he said, with the goal of getting the news release partially or fully retracted. Both Village Farms and TRLA declined to comment further on those discussions. The backstory behind the lawsuit started in September when Navarette, a migrant worker with a permanent home in El Paso, moved into an employee housing trailer in Monahans with four other women. Navarette later learned from co-workers that one of those women, whose full name is redacted in court documents, was symptomatic and later tested positive for coronavirus. Navarette, who shared a kitchen and bathroom with that woman, became concerned about possible exposure. She asked a supervisor if she could be informed if one of her co-workers was suspected or confirmed to have COVID-19. The supervisor said no, according to the lawsuit, citing confidentiality concerns. Navarette did not ultimately test positive for coronavirus, but at least one other co-worker at the facility apparently died of COVID, according to the lawsuit. Gemmel, the Village Farms representative, said the fact that Navarette was not informed by supervisors about her housemate's COVID diagnosis was a total communications error and an honest mistake. The company had retrained an HR manager at the Monahans facility after the incident to make sure such a situation did not happen again, he said. As a result of the settlement, Gemmel said the company would now provide special quarantine housing for exposed workers, but he insisted that the other policies, including notifying workers of potential exposures, were already on the books. The lawsuit and news release, he said, was risking Village Farms' reputation. The company had a 30-year record of doing what's right, he said, not only by running an ethical business, but by way of our employees and employee safety. In an interview after the settlement, TRLA offered comparatively positive assessment of Village Farms. The lawsuit started because Navarette, an older woman with pre-existing health conditions, was terrified about the prospect of catching COVID at work, said Maxwell Dismukes, a TRLA lawyer who helped handle the case. But Village Farms, he stressed, was quick to adopt additional precautions to help protect workers. As a result, he was hopeful the company could serve as a model and a beacon for other agricultural companies across the country. "We're aware of much worse conditions at other facilities at other companies," Dismukes added. He pointed to another case worked by TRLA, in which an employee at Larson Farms in the Texas Panhandle was put to work outside after showing symptoms of COVID-19. That worker later died. At press time, Gemmel said there were four active coronavirus cases at Village Farms in Marfa and Fort Davis. He argued Village Farms was doing its best to protect workers during the pandemic. He pointed to coverage last year in the Big Bend Sentinel when Dr. John Paul J.P. Schwartz, the local health authority for Presidio County, said the company was complying with everything and being very careful. The company around July saw a spike that resulted in at least 12 confirmed cases at its Tri-County operations, but the company soon adopted mask requirements in its facilities following an order from Governor Greg Abbott requiring masks in public places in counties with 20 or more active coronavirus cases. Previously, the company had only suggested them. Juror speaks out after Terlingua man's obscenity conviction. After reviewing evidence from the website, a juror said there was no doubt it violated obscenity laws. By Stephen Paulson, Brewster County. The criminal case against Tom Arthur, a Terlingua area man whom feds accused of running an obscene website focused on child sex abuse, meandered through the court system for more than a year. But when his trial finally started last week at a federal courthouse in Pecos, it didn't take long for jurors to convict him. The case was complex, drawing on federal obscenity laws from the 1930s. But one Marfa juror, who requested anonymity to discuss what he said was a disturbing trial, said there was no doubt among jurors that the horrific texts and drawings shown at trial were obscene and did not qualify for First Amendment protections. Jury selection began on Tuesday, and by Thursday morning, both the defense and prosecution had rested their case. Jurors spent less than an hour deliberating the case before returning guilty verdicts on all nine charges. The case against Arthur, as the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported, stemmed from an obscene website he started around 1996 and ran until 2019 when the FBI raided his home in Terlingua. The for-profit website was dedicated to publishing writings that detail the sexual abuse of children, including the rape, torture, and murder of infants and toddlers, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Texas said in a news release last week after the verdict was announced. Arthur faced three charges related to possessing and distributing obscene images through his website, five related to obscene texts, and a ninth charge for running a business focused on selling or distributing obscene materials. Users contributed content to his website, the name of which the Big Bend Sentinel is not printing, and it's unclear how much of the site's content Arthur produced. Nonetheless, all submissions for publication were reviewed and approved by Arthur before he posted them on the site, according to the news release. The site was also Arthur's sole source of income for more than 20 years, reportedly netting him up to $14,000 a month. Arthur will face sentencing on the charges in April. At press time, it's unclear if he will appeal. Arthur's lead lawyer, Mark Bennett, declined to comment on the case. The charges against Arthur were partially based on old obscenity laws, a detail that Bennett played up in court filings and in previous interviews with the Big Bend Sentinel. The case against Arthur was baseless, he argued in one filing, because it was Congress's job to impose rules on obscene content, not prosecutors. In another filing, he compared Arthur's trial to hauling a small-town librarian before a jury of her peers to defend stocking her shelves with a copy of Lolita. Bennett also tried to enter expert testimony from Dr. David Lay, a clinical psychologist based in New Mexico. In written testimony, Dr. Lay stated that materials on Arthur's website, while often distasteful and highly uncomfortable for many readers, cannot be shown to lack serious scientific, literary, or artistic value. He also stated that users of the website may experience decreased risk of contact offending against children. For reasons that aren't entirely clear, a federal court in Pecos decided that evidence wasn't admissible in court. Prosecution ultimately called five witnesses, including Sandra, Arthur's estranged wife, and an FBI agent who handled the case. Arthur did not testify at the trial, and his attorneys called no witnesses. In the end, though, Bennett's high-minded talk of obscenity and art did little to convince jurors. To qualify for First Amendment protections, objectionable content must be shown to have serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value, according to federal law. As jurors learned about Arthur's website and the case against him, they agreed with prosecutors that the content did not have these redeeming qualities. due to the nature of the case, the Big Ben Sentinel has not seen any of the obscene evidence presented against Arthur. In agreeing to an interview with the Big Ben Sentinel on Monday, the anonymous Marfa juror said he decided to speak out because he does not want Big Bend residents to doubt the validity of the charges against Arthur or think that any of the content fell into a gray area. Your article from the week before made a very strong attempt at being fair to both sides, that juror said. It was the same presumption of innocence that we all entered into the beginning of the trial with. But after the jury reviewed the obscene evidence, there was no doubt amongst the jury that the charges were valid. It was guilty on all 9 counts. That juror offered more context on the trial that he said had helped him and other jurors reach their unanimous verdict. For one, there was the size of the website and the scope of Arthur's involvement. The site hosted thousands of stories, according to evidence at the trial, as well as at least 840 paying subscribers. Arthur played an integral role in adding content to the site, including setting up dedicated author pages for the more than 2,000 contributors. He gave at least some of them email addresses. Those web users came from all over the country and world, and the website was hosted in the Netherlands, violating laws on transporting obscene content. Arthur designed a search engine for the website, the juror said, which allowed users to use code words to search for particular types of obscene content. The website had a large following, sometimes getting up to 100,000 unique hits a day and making profits of around $400,000 in 2002 alone, according to tax records presented at trial. And Arthur, from his home office in Terlingua, was in charge of the operation. Arthur spent 2 to 3 hours a day working on the website, and he'd have to handle all the admin stuff, like forgotten passwords, the juror said. He had a job, and he worked on it every day. Meanwhile, prosecutors also made a very strong case that there was no other income, the juror said. That website income is what paid for all the Terlingua property and developments. An FBI interview with Arthur from 2019 left the juror unsure about whether Arthur was aware of the scope of his crimes, but regardless, the jury didn't exactly think he was acting like an innocent man prior to his arrest. Arthur and his wife Sandra, who was granted immunity for her testimony, regularly changed business names, as, for example, banks found out about the nature of Arthur's website and cut ties with him. Arthur had mailing addresses in other cities, which forwarded to Terlingua. At the trial, prosecutors showed images of damaged hard drives that Arthur or someone associated with him had tried to bury on his property. He was definitely hiding stuff, the Marfa juror said. I don't know if he thought he was doing illegal things, but he was doing things to hide his name and location. The Big Ben Sentinel was unable to obtain full transcripts of closing arguments by press time, but the defense's closing argument, according to the juror, included a last-ditch argument by Bennett that people who used the site might have been less likely to commit physical offenses since they ostensibly had a fictional outlet for their urges. No evidence was presented in trial to back up that assertion, the juror said. As he and other jurors went to deliberate, he wondered whether one obscene story had actually been fictional or based on real crimes. That was my final thought before I went into the jury room, he said. The website served a very evil purpose of attempting to normalize deviant behavior through these stories. Car chase ends with 4 people detained. By Stephen Paulson, Presidio. A car chase in the Presidio area on Sunday ended with the detention of 3 migrants and the arrest of one person suspected of helping to transport them. The Presidio County Sheriff's Office was reportedly the lead agency on the incident, but the Sheriff's Office did not respond to multiple requests for comment. The Big Ben Sentinel has not yet seen an incident report. The Presidio Police Department, which also responded to the scene, said the case is still under investigation. According to a spokesperson for U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which also responded, The incident started when a PCSO deputy noticed a gray Chrysler 300 heading eastbound on River Road with just one person, a driver. A short time later, the CBP spokesperson said there were four people in the car, despite the fact that the car was on a remote part of River Road. This time, the car was going westbound towards Presidio. Those circumstances gave authorities probable cause to pull over the car, the spokesperson said, which a PCSO deputy then tried to do. But the car didn't stop, leading to a chase through Presidio. Around that point, Presidio police also apparently became involved. Presidio police declined to comment on the incident, noting that they were not the lead agency. They instead directed questions to the sheriff's office. John Ferguson, the Presidio mayor, was at the post office with his wife Lucy at around 10 a.m. when the chase tore through town. They heard somebody flip on their sirens, and then they saw the Chrysler. A few minutes later, the chase was heading the other way, towards East Presidio. It was just flying, Ferguson said of the getaway car. It was surreal. It's nice to know that law enforcement is out there taking care of our community, he added. They're there when you need one. Strike force of vaccinators plan tri-county visit as scarce doses are leading locals to travel far. By Abby Perot, Tri-County. County officials this week sought help from outside the Big Bend area, tapping into the 17-county Regional Advisory Council, J, they are part of, in hopes of bringing a strike force of vaccinators to the area soon. In the meantime, some Tri-County residents with health risks have traveled hundreds of miles to seek more immediate vaccinations. It has been a slow rollout in the 7 weeks since the vaccine arrived in Texas, with just 1,100 doses making their way into the Tri-County since late December. This week, 100 doses of Moderna arrived to Fort Davis Family Practice, which marks the first time the state has allocated COVID vaccines to Jeff Davis County. In preparation, the rural practice has a waiting list of patients that well outnumbers the vaccines arriving. But not all 100 doses will go to Fort Davis residents, said Selena Esquivel, the office manager at the family practice. Hospital employees in Brewster County who qualify under the state's 1A designation are first in line to get vaccinated in Fort Davis this Thursday. After the 1A vaccines are given, those from the 1B group, people over 65 or with certain health risks, will get vaccinated. Esquivel said the clinic has prioritized the remaining vaccine doses based on their patients' health statuses, curating the list in hopes of mitigating the most risk. According to Esquivel, hypothetically speaking, that prioritization might look like someone who is 48 with cancer and COPD getting the shot before someone who is 65 and healthy, despite both being eligible for the vaccine. Clinics in the Tri-County, often working with limited staff and resources, have at times struggled to handle the additional workload of mass vaccinations. Earlier this month, Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guavera began convening meetings about the vaccine, where officials could discuss and strategize about the rollout of the effort to immunize against COVID-19. First, she invited Tri-County officials, and as the weeks have worn on, the weekly Tuesday meetings have grown, adding in healthcare workers, the Rio Grande Council of Governments, state officials, and this week, the J Regional Advisory Council, JRAC. As Guevara informed officials last week that a larger share of vaccines was forecasted to arrive here in February, hospital and clinic executives explained their capacity for administering vaccinations, saying sharing the task of vaccination was necessary. For example, Preventative Care Health Services was having to disrupt their normal operations each time they received a batch of the Moderna vaccine. The process of giving the immunization took hours of time away from their regular patients, using staff to answer phones, coordinate vaccine appointments, inject the medicine, and promptly file documentation with MTRAC and with the Texas Department of Emergency Management. With more vaccines on the way, they wondered how they would face the immunization task. 1 week later, as the Tri-County vaccine meeting convened again, JRAC offered resources that could solve some of the stresses that are hitting local clinics and the hospital. Danny Updike, the organization's executive director, said in an interview Wednesday that Medical Center Hospital in Odessa and Midland Memorial Hospital in Midland have agreed to work with rural counties to come out and give vaccines to 1A and 1B eligible people. While working out logistics will come first, Updike said, I think they're thinking to get started within the next couple of weeks if everything works out. Though it's not all set in stone, Judge Guevara also thinks the arrival of Midland Memorial Hospital workers, who are slated to help Jeff Davis, Presidio, and Brewster counties, is just weeks away. In the call, Guevara pressed JRAC to not just arrive in Marfa and assume it would help all of Presidio County. It's well worth the effort to go to Presidio, she said in an interview after the meeting. At this time, the plan is for the strike force to visit and vaccinate residents in both cities in Presidio County. As vaccines still trickle into the area directly from the state's allocations, Esquivel, the Fort Davis Family Practice Office Manager, said the clinic doesn't know if or when we will receive another round of the first dose, and they are urging patients to get it wherever you can in the meantime. In the Tri-County, some residents are already driving hundreds of miles to larger cities where vaccines are more available. Marfa residents Rob Gunger and Simone Ruby set off to Pecos on Friday to receive the Pfizer vaccination. Gunger, a musician and co-owner with Ruby of Do Your Thing Coffee Shop, lived with a lot of fear and anxiety as the coronavirus pandemic took hold of the country last year. He has asthma, and while he was able to lose considerable weight during 2020, his BMI and respiratory condition still posed a risk high enough to put him in the 1B category. When you're an asthmatic, you know too well the feeling of not being able to breathe, he said. And so the idea of being at greater risk of suffocating to death really rocked me to my core. With his first dose of the vaccine administered last week and his booster shot set for later this February, he's already feeling a sense of optimism about the future. Earlier this month, Marfa resident Sarah Button saw information about vaccines in Midland and signed up her mother, adding her own name to the list as well. Soon, she was notified both were eligible for the vaccine this week. The pair will be making a 2-hour and 53-minute trip each way to get vaccinated at the Horseshoe Arena in Midland. Though Button's health status qualifies her under 1B, she said she has mixed emotions about how soon she will receive it. I'm really grateful we were able to get the vaccine, but I feel kind of guilty because there are so many people I feel need the vaccine more than I or my mom do. We stay home. I wish there was a plan for teachers or other people who are out more, Button said. The priority is strange to me, but I am grateful to be able to get the vaccine. In the Tri-County, some residents await appointments at their local doctor's office and, unable to travel or aren't sure whether they should hold off on getting on lists until more vulnerable patients have been able to get vaccinated. But Christina Wright, a nurse at the Department of State Health Services Clinic in Marfa, said directives from the state are that anyone eligible for the vaccine in 1A or 1B should take any chance at vaccination they can find. Go absolutely anywhere you can get it. It doesn't even matter if you go to New Mexico, she urged this week. Right now, if you can get it, get it. For more information about finding vaccines, visit our website at bigbensentinel.com. Border authorities see increase in migrant apprehensions near Valentine. Last week, U.S. Customs and Border Protection saw a significant increase in arrests of migrants across the Big Bend sector after they say smugglers pushed large groups of people through the Valentine, Texas area. In just around 48 hours last week, Border Patrol agents arrested over 100 undocumented migrants near Valentine. The migrants were traversing the rugged terrain in large groups. Last Wednesday morning, working with canine dogs, technology, and tracking techniques. Border Patrol agents apprehended the largest group of nearly 50 people. Five smugglers were also arrested and turned over to investigative authorities. This massive influx of people was caused by a push by transnational criminal organizations, CBP stated in a news release. The influx is especially concerning, the agency stated, due to the extreme cold weather and the impact of COVID-19 on West Texas residents. All subjects were processed according to Big Bend sector protocols for immediate removal or further criminal prosecution. Under Title 42, a section of federal law invoked by the administration of former President Donald Trump in March, migrants and other international travelers can be barred entry if the U.S. Surgeon General determines there is a serious danger of communicable disease spreading across U.S. borders, such as during the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Title 42, the CBP stated in its news release, helps the agency ensure that COVID-19 is not further introduced into the United States. Together, the agency stated, we can continue to uphold national security and combat illicit activity. Fatality counts show uneven effects of coronavirus in Tri-County. When it comes to who is dying in the pandemic, COVID-19 has highlighted all the things we've known all along, one expert said, by Stephen Paulson. As the coronavirus pandemic lingers in the Tri-County, it's exposed disparities in health outcomes, ravaging some communities while leaving others relatively unscathed. With 22 total fatalities, Presidio County has been hit far harder by the pandemic than either Brewster or Jeff Davis counties. Brewster County has had just 8 coronavirus deaths, despite a larger population and almost twice as many cases. Jeff Davis County has had just 1 death. In Presidio County, the divide is just as stark, though the data makes it harder to see. Both Judge Cinderella Guevara and Presidio County Health Authority, Dr. John Paul J.P. Schwartz, said they had not received a breakdown of where county deaths were happening. A spokesperson for the Texas Department of State Health Services said they could not provide that data beyond the county level. But numerous local health officials, including both Dr. Schwartz and Presidio EMS Director Melinda Richardson, said a significant majority of these 22 deaths had been in Presidio. The border city appears to have more cases than the entire rest of the Tri-County combined, including Marfa. That fits with the findings across the United States, where low-income and non-white communities have been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. Presidio is around 96% Latino. Around 40% of residents live below the poverty line. In 2019, the Big Bend Sentinel reported on a study compiled by Episcopal Health Foundation in Houston, which showed a wide disparity in life expectancies across the Tri-County. Brewster County residents live for an average of almost 88 years, while people in South Presidio County lived for an average of around 77. Take the less than 2-hour drive from Alpine to Presidio, in other words, and the average life expectancy of residents drops by more than a decade. The study pointed to a number of possible causes for local discrepancies like these, from race and income to the availability of fresh food. Episcopal hasn't done a follow-up study specifically comparing life expectancy data to coronavirus fatality rates, but in a new study with the nonprofit Altarum Institute, Episcopal highlighted the heavy burden of COVID on Black and Latino people in Texas. If Black and Latino people got sick and died from COVID at the same rates as white people, the study found, there would be more than 5,000 fewer deaths and more than 24,000 fewer hospitalizations across the state. And that study was from September. Around 20,000 more Texans have died of COVID since then. The study put those figures in other terms, too. Excess Black and Latino COVID deaths caused more than $5 billion in lost productivity for the state. The state has also lost more than 550,000 years of life when accounting for the expected lifespans of people who died of COVID. These numbers are a glaring reminder of how non-medical factors like economic status and living conditions impact health, and how COVID-19 is highlighting that in the worst way, Elena Marks, the president and CEO of Episcopal, said in a statement. Something has to change in Texas. It's those same factors like poverty and racial health disparities that help account for the differences in life expectancies across the Tri-County. COVID-19 has highlighted all the things we've known all along, said Brian Sasser, a spokesperson for Episcopal. Sasser gave the analogy of a checklist. There's a whole bunch of boxes to check, he said, from pre-existing conditions like diabetes to a lack of medical care and places to exercise. They're both economic and sociological. As a community checks more boxes, life expectancy goes down and COVID deaths rates go up. On average, low-income and non-white people check more boxes. Low-income people also face unique challenges in the COVID pandemic that wouldn't necessarily affect their general life expectancy. They're more likely to have frontline jobs, for example. They're more likely to live in multi-generational households, where a frontline worker in their 20s has more vectors to pass disease to an elderly relative. Sasser worries the same disparities will play out in vaccine distribution. We have to make sure that it's not just first come, first serve. Instead, he said, officials should be looking at where they could put vaccine distribution sites to ensure there is equity, for example, by placing them early in neighborhoods with high COVID death rates. Dr. John Ray, a doctor at Preventative Care Health Services, works throughout the Tri-County, including in Presidio. When asked about the disparities in death rates across the Tri-County, he said his work was focused on individual patients, not on big-picture trends. Even still, Dr. Ray said he had noticed a relative scarcity of medical resources in Presidio. There's no pharmacy. There's no physical therapy. The response to the pandemic has also varied greatly amongst communities in the Tri-County. Places like Presidio, with its high death rates, have taken the pandemic seriously, even launching a protest movement last year when Presidio Public Schools planned to require in-person schooling. In places like Jeff Davis County, where 97% of residents are white, where the median household income is more than $50,000, and where there's just been one COVID death, some residents have refused to wear masks or even acknowledge that there is an ongoing pandemic. Sasser, the Episcopal spokesperson, wasn't surprised to hear that. The more the pandemic affected a community, he said, the more seriously they would likely take it. You talk about in communities of color, and they just seem to know somebody who's been affected, he said, giving the example of a woman who lost her job, her brother, and a cousin to COVID. He compared the example of an executive at a meat plant to a worker at that same plant. Everything about that person's situation regarding COVID is different. COVID has highlighted long-standing injustices, Sasser said. I think it may be one of the silver linings of COVID, he said, that we start to become more aware of health equity issues. Those disparities aren't just about access to health care, but about making sure low-income and non-white families have access to healthy food, safe places to exercise, and strong support networks. Going forward, he hopes the pandemic will provide an impetus for Americans to finally start righting these wrongs.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, January 21st. Saturday fire leaves family injured and homeless. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Electrical issues at 4310 South Helen Street, the home of the Davis family, are suspected to be the blame of an early morning fire last Saturday, which completely engulfed the home in flames. The Saturday blaze started around 7:30 a.m. Several vehicles and firefighters from the Monahans Volunteer Fire Department arrived quickly at the scene to combat the blaze. The home was fully engulfed in flames by the time Fire Chief Randy Crabtree arrived on the scene, only a few minutes after the fire call came in. Three people were asleep in the home at the time of the fire. All three were able to escape the home, but not without injuries. The trailer was totally destroyed. Quote, "The fire began in the living room of the home and is suspected to be electrical in nature. The fire was so hot that it broke every window in the house and flames were coming out in all directions. It consumed the whole trailer very quickly," Crabtree said. All three members of the family were transported to Ward Memorial Hospital by Ward County EMS. Crabtree said the Davis family lost everything, and friends and neighbors were helping her with clothing and a place to stay. According to a Facebook post, as of Monday, grandmother Cindy Davis and her 10-year-old granddaughter had been released from the hospital. Cindy suffered small burns and some inhalation issues and was released to take care of the 10-year-old granddaughter, who was transferred to a children's hospital. The granddaughter suffered minor cuts and burns she received from breaking out her bedroom window due to the fire already at her room. Melissa Davis has a longer road to recovery due to soot and burns in her airways. Melissa escaped the fire, but later re-entered the home to get the dogs from inside, and that is where she collapsed from the smoke. Doctors will be inserting a camera to see what damage Melissa has from the soot. The Davis family will return to Odessa after the fire so they can get help from family. They do want to clear land and eventually put something back on the land here in Monahans. A GoFundMe has been set up for the family, which can be found by the following links, https://GoFundMe/254FE879, or donations can be dropped off at 701 North Betty Street, as a family member will pick up once we have collected. As of press time, the remains of the home had been bulldozed into a large pile of rubble. Crabtree said, quote, "With the extreme dry conditions, there is plenty of fuel around for more serious fires like this. We urge everyone to be especially careful and keep grass and weeds cut," end quote. One additional COVID-19 death reported. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The number of deaths in Ward County attributable to the COVID-19 virus now stands at 13, with one new death recorded over the weekend. The number of active cases as of Wednesday morning, according to the report from County Judge Greg Holly, was 181, up from 149 a week ago. Confirmed cases are 584, probable cases 369, and 759 recoveries. Quote, "Active cases in Ward County represent about 1.5% of the county's population. About 8% of the population has tested positive for or has been determined to probably have the virus at one time or another," Holly said. Ward Memorial Hospital had 13 patients on Tuesday, 9 who have tested positive for COVID-19. Statewide, there were 376,000 active cases, 1.8 million confirmed cases, 262,000 probable cases, and 32,000 deaths. Both Ward Memorial Hospital and Monahans Pharmacy have been approved for allocation of the COVID-19 virus vaccine, but there is no update on when the vaccine will be received. People can call either facility to be put on the waiting list. Phases 1A and 1B are eligible to receive vaccines. These include frontline health care workers, people over 65 years of age, and those 16 and over who have underlying health issues. Election called for Monahans Wicked Piute ISD trustees. Superintendent gets 5% pay raise. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Meeting in regular session on Monday night, the Board of Trustees called for the election of two trustees to be held on Saturday, May 1st. Up for re-election this year are Place 6 trustee Nancy Upchurch and Place 7 trustee Quint Melius. Early voting will begin on April 19th and end on April 27th. Ballots can be cast between the hours of 8 a.m. until 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. On Election Day, polls will be open from 7 a.m. until 7 p.m. Ballots for both early voting and Election Day will be at the School Administration Building at 606 South Betty in Monahans. Application for ballot by mail should be mailed or emailed to the early voting clerk, 606 South Betty Street in Monahans, or emailed to gnfisher@mwpisd.esc18.net. Those ballots must be received by April 19th at 4 p.m. Candidates, including incumbents, must submit applications between January 13th and February 12th at the school administration office. Candidates must be a United States citizen, 18 years of age or older, reside in the state for at least 12 months and in the district for 6 months, registered to vote, and may not have any felony convictions. In other business, R.J. Lopez, architect with Park Hill Smith & Cooper, updated the trustees on the 2019 bond construction programs. Construction is nearing completion at Tatum Elementary, Cullender Kindergarten, and Walker Junior High. Materials continue to delay the renovation at Walker Junior High. The Walker renovation was originally scheduled to be completed in November of 2020. Quote, "We are currently having issues with receiving required fire glass at Walker, Tatum, and Cullender. The auditorium at Walker is nearing completion, and we expect to be complete in the February-March timeframe. Demolition of the high school auditorium will begin when the Walker auditorium is complete," Lopez said. Status of other projects was also provided by Lopez. New parking lots are complete at Tatum and Cullender, and both of those renovations are about 95% complete. Construction of new natatorium is underway. Other demolition projects are on track. Bus barn renovation is out for bids, and construction should start in March. Steel work has started at the new elementary school, and the new school should be complete in less than a year. To date, about $20 million has been spent on bond projects. In other action, the trustees renewed the contract of Superintendent Chad Smith for the 2021-2022 school year, was approved. He was awarded a 5% pay raise to bring his salary to $129,000 per year.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.